From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we look at diversity in Milwaukee. Writer Evie Perry shares her research on how it works and how it's challenged in River West.
Later, we travel to Milwaukee's lakefront and find out what draws people of many backgrounds to the common space along Lake Michigan.
Lakefront calms me down. You know, I come down here to relax and just be, you know, just enjoy the natural beauty of the lake.
Plus, we explore the idea of the cosmopolitan canopy, places in cities where people of all backgrounds can coexist in a civil way.
It's an area of cultural convergence. You have old people, young people, black people, white people, Asians, Muslims, Jewish people, WASP, all kinds of people come together under the canopy.
Lake Effect comes your way after this news from NPR. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. People around the country are continuing to react with anger and horror to the events that took place over the weekend at a white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia.
It was at this time last year that racial tensions bubbled to the surface in Milwaukee. The violence that erupted in Sherman Park following a police shooting put the challenges of Milwaukee's black-white relations front and center for the rest of the country to see.
But as many residents of Sherman Park would urge the country to take a more nuanced view of their neighborhood, writer Evie Perry suggests there's another area that's important to study for how diversity can work.
Perry is a sociology professor at Rhodes College in Tennessee, but a native of the Milwaukee area and author of the book Live and Let Live: Diversity, Conflict, and Community in an Integrated Neighborhood. That neighborhood was River West. I spoke with her earlier this summer on stage at Boswell Book Company. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
What was your objective as this project coalesced and you and your partner moved to the neighborhood?
I will be honest in saying that, like most ethnographers, I didn't really know what I was getting into. So I had a lot of questions and a place, but those questions changed because the place inevitably changed me. So we are both from here, and though I didn't go to graduate school here, I really, really wanted to come home to do my dissertation research. I love Milwaukee, I feel very invested in Milwaukee, and I feel very worried about Milwaukee, and want to be a part of telling stories about this place that help us move forward. And I didn't know if I was going to be able to do that. But my questions were both sort of personal and sociological. So I'd studied a lot about segregation. So, and a lot of folks had studied a lot about segregation. We knew a lot about segregation and all the bad things that segregation does in terms of exacerbating racial and class tensions, in terms of concentrating poverty, in terms of creating very deep political divides, but we didn't know a lot about integration. So people kind of treated it like this thing to be celebrated, like of course integration will solve all of our problems if we can just get people to live together and watch the magic happen. Or they said, you know, there seems to be a lot of conflict and integrated neighborhoods never last and they're sort of lousy, so we need to find another solution. And that seemed to me like a perfect place to step in and say, well, instead of what it can be or what it's failing to be, what is it actually?
Well, and so talk about your methodology. I mean, you talk about the personal and you talk about the sociological. Is there a complexity in the intersection of living in a place and also studying it?
Yes, I would say it's full of complexity, which is what makes it work. So I lived in the neighborhood for 3 years, and I just did life in the neighborhood in a sort of classic Evie, really intense way. So I became really, really embedded in neighborhood life, sought out all different sorts of people to talk to spend time with, to go about their daily rounds with them, to sit on their porches, to go to all sorts of clubs and activities, and again, 36 bars. And I think there's something about doing the life of a neighborhood as a new person that makes you really, really sensitive to the ways in which you are adjusting to a new place, and how people deal with it in really different ways from you and different ways from one another. And of course, interviewing people is invaluable. I think you also enjoy interviewing people. And so that was a really wonderful way, and I see some people I interviewed here, for people to really share their journey through this neighborhood, if they were potentially born in it or moved to it, and sort of what it became to them. I think the complexity for me was when I actually had to sit down and write the thing, to see patterns and really document those patterns and be very honest about what I saw and work on not sort of overly romanticizing a place that I had totally fallen in love with.
Well, right. I mean, if doing what you were doing kind of gave you license to be nosy, and I think I know a little something about that phenomenon, what were the kinds of questions that you were asking, and did you see things change over the 3 years that you lived there in terms of how willing people were to share, you know, their warts and all kinds of impressions of the place that they live and love?
So I'll start with change over time. I think I was actually astounded by how willing people were to share warts and all with me from the beginning. And I think I was able, I'd like to believe I was able to build some level of trust that what I was really invested in was understanding how they saw things. Not this perfect picture, or even a picture that mattered for anyone else, but just you. How do you live in this neighborhood? How do you see it? What worries you? What do you love? When do you think about moving, if ever? And I was amazed at people's generosity. I think what changed for me was that the neighborhood became familiar. And so it's funny looking back at my field notes from my early days in the field, the things that shocked me or surprised me, the noises, for example, I couldn't even hear them by the time I left. So I would usually, and this could be an informal interaction or sitting down and interviewing someone, I would always ask people stories. So what is the story of how you came to live in this neighborhood? And again, for some people, it was they were born in the neighborhood. And then I would have them take me through lots of their contrasts, their evaluations, best and worst, things they would love to see, things that have changed, their perceptions have changed, and let their stories lead me into our exploration. And again, always encouraging people to embed their observations in things that actually happen.
Well, and so I feel like this is almost tantamount to asking you to go through your book point by point. But what were the primary sources of tension that you identified, even among people who were, by and large, it seems, very glad to be where they were? What were the points of friction?
So there were smaller frictions and larger frictions. And because I focused so much on life on the block, I was really interested in those everyday kinds of tensions and conflicts. And those were over all sorts of things. Property maintenance, how well did you keep up your house, or how wild is your garden? Noise level, right? So how loud are you? Child rearing. You know, what are the ways in which you're raising your children out in public? Public drinking, substance abuse, leisure activities, what's disruptive, what's okay? Economic activities, what's not legal and okay, what's not legal and okay? These everyday kinds of negotiations. And those tensions, though they sometimes created negative sorts of conflict, sometimes even violence, certainly hurt feelings, I, in the end, came to see as really vital to neighborhood life. That conflict, actually, these little conflicts produced these opportunities to get to know people, to understand what kind of our standards are, as flexible and kind of fluid as they may seem, and to not have one standard for a way to be in a neighborhood that had so many different kinds of people being in so many different kinds of ways. And without that conflict, I feel like the most dominant would win, and they would sort of push down their way of being in the world on the rest. And instead, it was just this sort of beautiful, sometimes ugly, often funny river of negotiation. And I'd like to think that along the way, sometimes people also got a better sense of where someone else was coming from. Because if I'm never going to engage with you about why you're making me so mad, Mitch, I'm not going to learn much about why you do what you do.
And one of the conflicts that really stuck with me is this, I think you call it a neighborhood navigation rubric, a very sociological term for a chart. Can you describe the distinction between the ideas of live and let live, which, you know, product placement here, and hold to a higher standard?
So this was one of those larger tensions that I saw playing out in the neighborhood. So live and let live, these folks tended to see the neighborhood as a place that needed to be preserved and protected. So diversity is our strength was an actual mantra that I heard again and again and again. And for them, problems were defined not in a really clear-cut way. So something wasn't problematic because it was illegal. It wasn't problematic because it was in violation of a city code. It was problematic when it did harm. And harm could be addressed on a block-by-block basis, on a neighbor-by-neighbor basis. And so the way that they went about dealing with problems started with talking with the neighbor, right? So that was the approach. And only if things really escalated would they move to something like calling the landlord, calling the Department of Neighborhood Services, calling police. So there was this kind of this slow escalation, personal first. Hold the neighborhood to a higher standard. These are people who are also very deeply invested in the neighborhood, who really cared about River West, and they were really invested in its potential. So they wanted to see it grow and develop. They wanted to see crime drop. They wanted to see smart economic development. You know, sometimes they wanted to see their property values rise, which I think we can understand. And they wanted to hold the neighborhood to a higher standard, and a very clear set of standards, standards that are laid out in what is legal, standards that are laid out in, you know, what is also sort of just mainstream white right, like a version, a cultural version of good. And they, though they sometimes engage neighbors, were much more quick to call police or pull in the authorities and tended to have really strong relationships with people in power and were able to use those to the advantage. So I think these are people who are all invested in the neighborhood, but have very different ways of defining and dealing with problems.
I gather that graffiti is one of those areas where this really sort of comes to a head.
It is indeed. Is graffiti art or is it blight? Does it signal that this is a creative neighborhood full of artists, or does it signal that this is a dangerous neighborhood where we have lost all control? So this was certainly one area where there was a lot of disagreement. And one of the interesting projects some of you may know about is the Art in the Alleys project, where some neat folks in the neighborhood asked muralists to throw up murals on people's garages in the alleys in the neighborhood. And a lot of homeowners agreed, and a lot of artists readily agreed. And some of them looked like graffiti. And this really upset some residents. They thought that somehow there's art, and then this is something else. And I think it's not, if you push that a little bit further, sometimes it's something else is youth, it's crime, and it's black and brown people. This kind of tangle of pathology that is associated with graffiti. And neighborhood folks fought back and forth. When larger issues came up around the city, when a Southside alderman tried to pass something that basically said that you can't put up graffiti on your own property, River Westerners went nuts and let him know just what they thought of that proposed ordinance. But, you know, it's really hard. For some people, they feel like it's sending the wrong signal about the neighborhood. It looks like disorder. And for other people, it looks like a place they value and love.
A lot of people, academics and the rest of us alike, have made the point that we're not always very good at living with difference. After all of your research, do you think the people of River West are any different? Realizing that many of them are in this room?
Yes. Yeah, I think in many ways we, people living in the United States, are not very good at living with difference. And I think a big reason why we are not good at living with difference is because we don't have a lot of good practice. And I think that's particularly true for people with more power, people who have, people who have lots and lots of resources, people who are white. I think it's because of segregation. And so lousy practice or a lack of practice can generate a real lack of skills, I guess. So yes, in some ways I think people in River West have figured out and are constantly in the process of figuring out ways to live with difference. It is not, however, a story that is simple or easy. So one of the things that I learned from people in River West is that it takes work, and it takes work all the time. So if you're really willing to regularly be engaging people and trying to understand them in context, I mean, I think of it as kind of like a practical empathy. And I don't think people necessarily develop it because they want to be good. I think it's a good way to survive in River West and thrive in River West. Is to, for example, pay attention to your neighbors. I mean, there's some River West folks here, I think you know this. You pay attention to your neighbors, you're gonna make your life easier, your block safer. So there's this shared fate, sometimes it comes in the form of shared threat, that really encourages people to engage and work things out. And I think there are a lot of lessons we have from River Westerners. I think if we look at a lot of diversity initiatives in corporations or universities, they're very much about sort of bringing people in and having people act like us and get with the program. And River West, that doesn't fly. It's subtle, but it's radical. It's, okay, come on in and let's see what mess we can kind of create together.
I think 3 years of work went into this. At the end of those 3 years, what questions did you still have that you don't think you were able to answer?
So many. First, how do we maintain this? So even one of the questions that I was able to, I think, answer to a certain degree is, so how is it that this continues beyond year after year? It's difficult to see how, in the face of continued threats for things like gentrification or decline, and a profound lack of affordable housing, how, in particular, we'll be able to maintain class diversity. I'm not sure how to do that. And a question that I get a lot is, so how do we create this elsewhere? What does this look like in policy? And if you look at some of the mixed income communities that policy has created, I mean, HUD, Housing and Urban Development, has put tons of money into tearing down concentrated poverty projects and building mixed income communities. And those communities typically do not look anything like River West. Poor people in those communities, the renters and the public housing residents, are heavily policed. They're under a lot of surveillance and generally feel excluded, even though they're integrated, they're excluded. And how do you translate something that is really deeply cultural when you're building it from scratch? So those are some of the questions I'm left with.
Well, and do you feel like, I mean, is it your job as a sociologist and an ethnographer to suggest what to do with what you learned, or do you sort of have to be able to turn this information and these lessons you got loose and let people do with it as they can?
Yes and yes. I do not pretend for a minute to have all or even many of the answers. Although I do think a lot of River Westerners have some great answers, some of whom didn't agree with me at all. I think that it is my responsibility as someone who has been lucky enough to study a place, to share that place, and to really think deeply about how we might translate this into some positive change. I mean, I'm a sociologist because I care deeply about justice, and I am a ridiculous optimist, and actually think that we are capable of creating a more just and equitable society. But I know that I need a team to do that. So I don't pretend, I don't have the hubris to claim that I have the answers. But I also think that it's important to really invest in the scientific project of simply understanding. And absolutely, if you make it accessible enough, which I hope this is, turning it over to people who can make it even better.
Well, and so I feel like this is a loaded question. Milwaukee, for a couple of years, has gotten a national reputation as this segregated place where people just aren't getting along. Do you think there's a counter-narrative that needs to happen to get the message of Milwaukee out to the rest of the country, and does that counter-narrative include River West?
I think we need two sets of counter-narratives. I think we really need some internal counter-narratives. So I listen a lot to the stories that people tell me about their neighborhoods and where they live. I also listen to people tell me about the places they won't go or don't go and why. And I think in Milwaukee, a lot of folks have stories about places they won't go and reasons for why they won't go there that are uncharitable, damaging, wrong, unfair. And I think that if we start taking the time to change our narrow-minded and limited stories about other places in the city, that's a really good start to trying to tell other people about who we are as a different place. So yes, and certainly I think River West is part of that story. Again, it's not like River West is trouble-free. I know there are lots of things that I think are really amazing about it. It has its own challenges. And I think we have a lot to learn from that place. But for starters, you know, think about the places that you drive through and the assumptions you make about what you see. And that was one of the amazing things about River West. What looks like chaos and trash to outsiders is gold sometimes, or at least entertaining to insiders. And then inevitably, I think, it will change the ways that we think about and define a good neighborhood. I think that that goes right along with the really simplistic stories we tell about good neighborhoods and bad neighborhoods, and I dare you to find me one of either of those.
Evie Perry is a sociology professor at Rhodes College in Tennessee and is a Milwaukee area native. Her recent book about River West is called Live and Let Live: Diversity, Conflict, and Community in an Integrated Neighborhood.
Keep listening. We'll explore another take on diversity, the concept of the cosmopolitan canopy, when Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Before the break, we spoke with writer Evie Perry about her research on how diversity works in the River West neighborhood. But River West is not the only place in Milwaukee where people of diverse backgrounds congregate.
Another sociologist, urban ethnographer Elijah Anderson, calls places where cultures converge cosmopolitan canopies. We'll hear more about that concept a little later in the show. But first, Lake Effect's Mayon Silver spent some time in one place that might fit the definition here in Milwaukee, the lakefront, and spoke with a variety of people about what the space means to them.
It's about dusk. James Greer and his granddaughter Daviana are standing on the edge of the lake, watching the waves crash in as the water splashes their shoes. It's their summer pastime to walk down to the lake from his neighborhood on 28th and Wells, and Daviana explains what comes next.
We sit, we watch, and we eat a couple of snacks, and we come down to the lake, and we just watch the lake and play in the sand. But he's scared of the water, so...
So you don't go in?
I go in, he don't go in.
It's not just whether to go into the water that the two disagree on.
I've been coming down here since I was, I'm 70 years old now. I've been coming down here since...
You were not 70, you were 60.
I'll be 70 in November.
He'll be 70 in November, he only 69.
I can't wait. I'm so proud of being 70.
Regardless of Greer's self-imposed premature aging, he's been taking Daviana to the lakefront for the past 3 years, and he says it's his favorite spot in the United States.
Lakefront calms me down, you know. I come down here, I'll just explain that to her. You know, I come down here to relax and just be, you know, just enjoy the natural beauty of the lake.
Kirby Fink was sitting on a bench facing McKinley Beach. She had a similar sentiment.
I like it because it's like a real life, you know, like those relaxation CDs that people play. I really like it because it's like a real life version of that.
Brooklyn Stewart, a friend sitting next to her, chimed in.
I feel like whenever I go to the lake, it's kind of like a therapy session. We definitely came down here today just to like talk about stuff, vent, and just like be open.
It's a place where people come sometimes for a respite from the tensions of everyday life and these other settings.
Elijah Anderson is a professor of sociology at Yale University. He coined the concept of a cosmopolitan canopy. He wrote about it in relation to Philadelphia, which is also known for racial and ethnic segregation. But he says that one or more of these areas exist in most every metropolitan area. It's a part of a city that he describes this way.
Well, it's an area of convergence. It's an area of cultural convergence. You have old people, young people, black people, white people, Asians, Muslims, Jewish people, WASP, all kinds of people come together under the canopy.
Danielle Friends is sitting on the grass to the south of McKinley Beach, watching her son at the playground.
It's like you get different cultures down here. You know, everybody is just down doing their own thing, you know, and everybody respect everybody, and I like that. You know, you got your bikers, you got your riders, your skaters, your walkers, your runners, and then you have your kids and, you know, family time and people just down by themselves sitting down. I enjoy it.
When asked if she sees segregation of groups, races, or ethnicities at the lakefront, Friends says,
go back into high school, you know, you have your nerds, your geek squad, the people that, the jocks, you know, what else were they? You know, the people, the goths, you know, different types of people, you know, the fun people, the naysayers. But I mean, at the end of the day, you can still walk the whole entire beach. You know, you don't have to worry about that. Yes, you can see the different areas where different cultures will go to. But at the same time, you also see, like, at the children's area, kids don't see color. So they all different types of colors is going to play on the playground. You know, that's where you will see the mixed crowd. You know, and you might see it on the beach, too.
As far as strangers interacting, she says that in general, people are doing their own thing.
Yeah, I think everybody's pretty much on the go, you know, unless they sitting down, you know, and enjoying the time. Some people just come down here to get a peace of mind, and others, you know, they might come down to talk or something, but I think it's like kind of a high and by type of situation, you know.
Namra Mirza Haq was walking down the path by Veterans Park, looking for a new picnic spot with her husband Amar. They moved to Milwaukee 2 years ago from Chicago.
You know, if you walk by someone, they'll smile at you, say hi, and I think that's maybe even a little different than the Chicago lakefront where it's so crowded that, you know, that's not really what happens. So, I think it's one of those spaces where people are inviting, and I think because of the calm environment, that kind of seeps into everyone's demeanor, and you can see that.
Back at McKinley Beach, Brooklyn Stewart adds,
I definitely feel like everyone here is at least like accepting of each other. And to me, that's like the first step of really being able to start talking to other people.
Professor Anderson says that this getting along that happens in the canopy, even at a basic level, means something.
It's a metaphor, really, for civil society. Civil society. This is the society that our ministers and teachers and parents encouraged us to participate in as small children. They try to bring us upright, that kind of thing. And the idea is to be pleasant and polite to strangers or people who are sharing that space with you. There are white spaces, black spaces, and there are racially mixed spaces. And these spaces are in flux, changing from white to black, black to white. But the canopy is a mixed space, and it's also a perceptual category. Not everybody sees it the same way, but they do feel it. And sometimes you have to go to the canopy just to get a dose of humanity. At least I do sometimes.
Namra Mirza Haq's husband, Amar, explains further why this space is important to him.
There's less a feeling of otherness. You know, not being white, not being from Wisconsin, you know, not being Christian. And so, you know, I feel just as welcome here as I would in, you know, Chicago.
As the sun was setting, over by the lakefront's built-in gym bars, David Jefferson and Ricky Davis II were working out. They took a minute from their reps to put it this way.
It's like a wonderful, like, I guess you could say a rainbow in a way. Like every like cultural, race, ethnicity, just it's just a fun atmosphere to be around in.
For Lake Effect, I'm Mayan Silver.
You can see a slideshow of faces from the lakefront at WUWM.com.
We'll take another break now, and when we return, we'll speak more with Elijah Anderson about the cosmopolitan canopy and what it might mean to American cities like Milwaukee. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
Can I kick it?
Yes, you can.
Can I kick it?
Yes, you can.
Can I kick it?
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The Nigerian-American writer Teju Cole once described his concept of home as fourfold. After Lagos and New York City, he is most at home wherever there is a good Wi-Fi connection and whenever he is among cosmopolitan people, in a place where people of different backgrounds figure out how to inhabit the same space and have the same rights and respect as everyone else.
We've been talking about the so-called cosmopolitan canopy on today's show, a term coined by the urban ethnographer Elijah Anderson. Anderson spent time observing and interviewing people in Philadelphia's Center City, a place that included historical landmarks, cultural centers, park spaces, and markets. He explored the lessons that can be drawn in his book, The Cosmopolitan Canopy, Race and Civility in Everyday Life. He explained his research to Lake Effect's Mayan Silver.
Well, I'm an ethnographer, which means I study people. I study culture. I study the way people come together and make sense of their lives. And the canopy, say the cosmopolitan canopy, is this island of civility located in a sea of racial segregation. And people in the canopy basically behave themselves as comity. There's goodwill. There's civility. It's an island of civility located in a sea of segregation. And there are two kinds of people in the under the canopy. There are people who are deeply ethnocentric and people who are cosmopolitan. And sometimes it operates in the same person. People code switch. But it's this place of cultural convergence. And it's a place where people come sometimes for a respite from the tensions of everyday life in these other settings. Philadelphia is a very segregated city, but the center city is quite racially mixed, quite diverse. And Rittenhouse Square or the Reading Terminal Market, and there are other spaces too that reflect this diversity.
People come to know each other in these cosmopolitan canopies through folk ethnography. I was going to ask you what that is.
Well, it's kind of people watching. Well, we all do it. We all make sense of people and situations. And it's a fun thing to do sometimes. Folk ethnography is a way for people to know what's going on, to sort of understand their world. And it doesn't mean that they're always right. It doesn't mean that they're always correct in what they assume, what they see. But it's a way for them to make sense of people and situations, you see, and places.
And is that one of the reasons that a cosmopolitan canopy in a city is so important? Because it gives people the opportunity to watch other people that aren't like them, in a sense, in some ways?
Well, it's an area of convergence. It's an area of cultural convergence. You have old people, young people, black people, white people, Asians, Muslims, Jewish people, WASP, all kinds of people come together under the canopy. And usually there's some reason, like it's a market or something like that, or it's just a park that people like and they come there and it's a pleasant space. It's a metaphor, really, for civil society. Civil society. This is the society that our ministers and teachers and parents encouraged us to participate in as small children. They try to bring us upright, that kind of thing, and the idea is to be pleasant and polite to strangers or people who are sharing that space with you, that kind of thing. And so the canopy exemplifies that kind of a setting, civil society.
And it's also important that the space belongs to all kinds of people, right?
Right, and that's. Again, that's the civil society, you see.
So can you describe some of the things in society that cause cosmopolitan canopies to be something that is not necessarily out of the ordinary, but unique? What is the rest of society? What's going on there?
Well, I mean, Philadelphia is a very segregated place. There are white spaces, black spaces, and there are racially mixed spaces. And these spaces are in flux, changing from white to black, black to white. But the canopy is a mixed space, and it's also a perceptual category. And not everybody sees it the same way, but they do feel it. And sometimes you have to go to the canopy just to get a dose of humanity. At least I do sometimes. I know the Rittenhouse Square in Philadelphia is a wonderful place, as is the Reading Terminal Market. And every city has at least one or two of these places. Some have more. I can count about six of these spaces in Philadelphia and in Center City and other places. And they play off of one another. You know, there's a kind of synergistic effect. And from that synergy comes this cosmopolitan zone, as it were. So there's a sense in which Center City, Philadelphia, is this cosmopolitan zone, you see. But, you know, New Haven has maybe one or two of these spaces. New York, if you have the street corners like a canopy, there's such a diversity of people. And they're getting on in the sense of being civil to one another, which is superficial to be sure. But they are typically civil to one another. Now, the canopy itself, it's diverse, it's It's mixed. All kinds of people are there. And people are basically, as I say, civil to one another. But the canopy does have fault lines. And once in a while, a fault line will erupt and there'll be a problem.
You had a chapter in your book, The Color Line and the Canopy, and you referred back to 1903 when W.E.B. Du Bois wrote that the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line.
Right.
And can you explain why that was prescient and what some of the ways that that persists today?
Well, in 1903, the color line was very bright, so to speak, and people knew it. People sort of understood it, and black people certainly knew when they weren't wanted. They knew where they weren't wanted. They knew their place, so to speak, and white people tended to keep them in that place, you see. And we're talking about really the emergence of the so-called the iconic ghetto. Now, the iconic ghetto is this place in cities where people assume black people live, you see. And this goes back to slavery. After slavery, which established the black body at the bottom of the order, as black people migrated after the Civil War, they approached cities north and south. And when they arrived in number, they were oftentimes contained in certain areas of the city. And other people in these spaces, oftentimes ethnic minorities and folks, tended to distance themselves from blacks. And the cities tended to contain blacks in certain areas, you see, and these became black spaces. And these have morphed into ghetto communities to this day. So the city today can be seen as being comprised of black space, white space, and racially mixed space. And whereas in the past, the color line was oftentimes quite clear. Because of the big changes that have occurred over the years, especially the incorporation process that happened after the civil rights movement, and what we have now, we have black people everywhere. People are doctors and lawyers, and they live in the larger society. But at the same time, there are issues, and black people who move about in the larger society once in a while run into this moment of acute disrespect based on their blackness. And that happens under the canopy. It doesn't happen all the time, but it happens on occasion. And that's when the canopy itself gets rented. And then it has to repair itself, so to speak, and people try to do that by trying to pay attention to what caused the tear. And so the color line is more emergent today, it seems, than it was back in the days of W.E.B. Du Bois. And it's that moment of acute disrespect when that's when the color line is drawn today. So there's a difference between what is going on now and what was happening in the days of Du Bois.
Well, society has opened in some ways, but there still remains some entrenched structural problems.
Well, we've come a long way. I mean, in this country, we've come a long way since slavery, but we have a very long way to go. And under the canopy, there are essentially two types of people. I talk about this in my book. There are people who are deeply, deeply cosmopolitan, meaning they appreciate all kinds of people. And these are oftentimes people who are educated, who've been exposed to different kinds of people, who've grown up with the orientation of acceptance of difference and diversity, that kind of thing. And oftentimes, as I say, these people are not only better educated, but they're oftentimes more privileged. At the same time, there are people who are deeply, deeply ethnocentric, if not parochial. And when they come to the canopy, they're oftentimes provoked, disturbed, what have you. But the canopy as a space encourages people to be civil. It encourages a kind of cosmopolitanism, so to speak, a cosmopolitan orientation. And so the people who are deeply, deeply ethnocentric might have difficulty operating under the canopy, whereas the people who are deeply cosmopolitan can feel at home. But the people who are deeply ethnocentric sometimes have to stretch in order to meet the norms of the canopy. And there comes a moment, there comes a time when people who are ethnocentric and who are presenting themselves as cosmopolitan sometimes they can feel like they've had enough. They become stressed out maybe when they see diversity of a certain sort or people out of their supposed place. And this is when they act out, or the gloss begins to erode, the social gloss, that is. And this tension emerges. And so the people who are marginalized, whether they're Black people or whether they're Muslims or whether they're Jewish or whether they're gay or whether they're women or whoever it is with a difference, these people can feel insulted, you see, and marginalized. And that's that moment of acute disrespect. And that's when the color line or the line is drawn between and among groups, you see. And there's tension there, but the canopy oftentimes recovers, and people learn from the experience, and they move on. But this is not usual in civil society and under the canopy. The canopy is a beautiful place, but there are fault lines, you see.
Yes, and you write about how, especially for young Black males, there's when people are doing this folk ethnography or this people watching, you wrote about how in public, stereotypically, white skin color is associated with respectability, civility, trust, and Black color is associated with poverty, danger, and distrust, above all with regards to anonymous young males. But at the same time, there's in the cosmopolitan canopy, there's a sense of it's characterized by its sense of safety. And so people let down their guard a little bit in the canopy and they feel comfortable to explore, to let their fears down and that type of thing.
That's right. Well, as Black people navigate the white space, or as they navigate the cosmopolitan space, because of this iconic ghetto that hovers overhead, they move about in this space with a deficit of credibility. That is, people are not convinced that they're not from the ghetto, so to speak. The iconic ghetto, as I mentioned, is a very powerful, powerful source of stereotype, prejudice, and discrimination. And this hovers over the canopy, you see.
Well, and in your book, you do, you know, personal anecdotes from people, and you talk to people, and you talk to people from the iconic ghetto, from the gallery in an area in Philadelphia that's predominantly African American, and you talk about that there's a humanity. I mean, everybody has a humanity, and everybody has things to share and things to add to society. And, you know, you talk about people that may not feel comfortable going into the gallery, but there are other, for instance, white people that may be more open or accepted to that kind of thing.
Right. People who are somewhat culturally sophisticated and open, and there are people who are closed, who are more ethnocentric. And the ones who are cosmopolitan oftentimes are much more able to be tolerant and respectful of difference. And people who are deeply, deeply ethnocentric or even parochial have a more difficult time with that. In fact, the canopy is this place where the cosmopolitan person can feel at home. The ethnocentric person of any race might feel challenged under the canopy, you see. And so there's a sense in which the norms of the canopy spread, and because of the power of those norms, the most ethnocentric person sometimes tries to pass as cosmopolitan, you know, and they do this by painting themselves in a kind of gloss, and which deflects scrutiny, and they act real nice and they're pleasant and all that, until they don't, until they've had enough, until they're so provoked that that they draw the color line in their minds, or they look for allies, and pretty soon there can be tension. So it isn't a place without its issues. I mean, it is a place where all different kinds of people come. It's a beautiful place when it's working. At the same time, there are fault lines.
When that kind of ties into, I was wondering why it's important that racial separateness is not Philadelphia's only story and not Milwaukee's only story, that there are these cosmopolitan canopies.
Exactly. No, as I said before, the canopy is an island of civility located in a sea of segregated living, you see. And it's a place for various kinds of people come together. It's a place of convergence. It's a place for old people, young people, black people, white people, Jewish people, Muslims, all kinds of people come together under the canopy. And typically, things are fine. But these spaces do have fault lines.
Thank you very much, Professor Anderson, for speaking about this. It's a fascinating book, and it really ties into what's going on in Milwaukee.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me on your program.
Elijah Anderson is a professor of sociology at Yale University. His book is called The Cosmopolitan Canopy, Race and Civility in Everyday Life. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mayon Silver, and there is more on his work at WUWM.com.
One more break, and then a Lake Effect essayist considers the concept of the good old days. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. So-called white supremacists demonstrating in Charlottesville, Virginia over the weekend told reporters they felt emboldened by the election of Donald Trump last fall and his calls to, quote, take America back, unquote.
Lake Effect essayist Jim Spangler has been thinking about the America to which some would like to return.
There is much talk these days about what old-timers call the good old days. Now, all that's been co-opted by some fellow in Washington, D.C. as Make America Great Again. So, if we are going to make America great again, we have to assume it was once greater at some time in the past. While the fellow in the red baseball cap has not singled out a particular time, I'd vote for the 1950s. One reason is I'm old enough to remember the 50s. Maybe all that Make America Great talk is what prompted my daughter, a political junkie, to ask me the other day, "Dad, tell me about the 1950s. In response, I rattled off a few top-of-the-head memories. But, like the lyrics of a song I couldn't get out of my head, I kept coming back to the question, were the 50s really that different, or was it just the optimism of youth that colors my memory? Let's explore this whole thing and compare the 1950s to where we are today, and presumably, where the red baseball cap fellow, I guess, wants us to go. We can start with statistics, but I promise I won't bury you with them. First, economics have changed. In the 1950s, almost half the world's production of goods were produced in the USA, and in cars, trucks, and farm tractors, it was 80%. Why? The rest of the major economies of the world were still struggling to recover from the destruction of World War II. As a result, we didn't have much competition. Producers could raise prices and wages to meet union demands without losing market share. As a result, wages went up faster, in some years much faster, than the cost of living. Now, things are different. Instead of 50% of production, the U.S. share is about 20%. Want proof? Look around your house. See if you can find a Made in USA label in your clothes closet. Don't forget the garage. If I could, I'd like to ask the fellow in the red hat, what's the plan to return to the economics of the 1950s? Politics have changed. In 1960, the Pew pollsters asked about people's trust in government. Then, 70% said the government would do the right thing always or most of the time. Today, Pew says the question gets 20%. The approval rate for Congress is even worse, in a dead heat with Jack the Ripper. Again, Mr. Redcap, with the dysfunction in Washington, what's the plan to fix it? Our personal lives have changed. Gallup reported in 1950, about half the population attended religious services on a, quote, regular, unquote, basis. Today, the Huffington Post quotes sources that say the number is between 30 and 20%, probably closer to 20. The divorce rate has doubled since 1955, and children born outside marriage have increased fivefold. This, according to the National Vital Statistics Report, a government agency. Assuming the goal is to return us to the personal life of the 1950s, and I'm not sure that is the goal, how do you turn back that clock? So much for all the numbers. I believe that the subjective differences between the 50s and today are even more telling. Granted, this is my opinion. And if you, like me, qualify for geezerhood, your memories of the 50s may be different. There was an unbridled optimism in the 50s. We all had a little Rosie the Riveter in us. We won the largest war in history, worked our way out of the Great Depression, conquered polio with the Salk vaccine. We had television sets, TV dinners, and room air conditioners, two-tone cars with fins, automatic transmissions, and V8 engines. If Rip Van Winkle awoke from a 10-year sleep in 1960, he'd hardly recognize the place. So, Mr. President, can you pull a Rosie the Riveter rabbit out of that red hat of yours? Life seemed less stratified and more homogenized. We were all in this thing together. Like all the other guys, I rode my bike to junior high. No mom's taxi for me. And never owned a bicycle lock. Dad carpooled to work with two top executives and another mid-manager like himself. The pickup baseball game in the schoolyard across the street included boys from across the economic spectrum. Never mind how much your dad made. Can you hit? Can you field? Boys would sleep in backyard tents on warm summer nights, and nobody gave their safety a thought. We mowed our own grass, washed our own cars, and painted our own houses. Of all things I miss about those days 60 years ago, I long for those things the most. Well, maybe not painting the house part. Maybe I miss it so much because I know this was a time that can never be again. Mr. Red Hat is not the first, and he won't be the last to use a catchy slogan. Kennedy talked about the new frontier. LBJ had the Great Society. Nixon had his silent majority. Reagan, his shining city on a hill. And George W. Bush told us about compassionate conservatism. Tell me, have we already forgotten hope and change? The 50s are gone, and I was fortunate enough to be a part of that era. Maybe, just maybe, we will be both smart and lucky. And maybe, if we conduct ourselves with an eye on the future as we should, someday, 60 years from now, my great-nephew will echo his then-long-gone great-uncle by saying, "Remember the good old days?"
You can find a full archive of Jim Spangler's essays for Lake Effect at WUWM.com. And that is Tuesday's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today. And please be with us tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. NPR in Milwaukee.
It is 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.